Greetings and welcome to another installment of Fuckboys of Literature. I'm your host, Emily Edwards. Every episode of the podcast has been discussing the character or author wildly considered a bad boy of literature, whether because of power plays, screwed up romances, vanity, or a combination of any such negative character traits. My guests and I have concluded that these characters were just no good. But today, my guest and I are going to bat for a character near universally considered a literary fuckboy. Today, we're defending the honor of Holden Caulfield. My guest today is writer and artist Emmett Cameron. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here.
So far, I've asked my guests to pick their own topic for the show, and you and I landed pretty quickly on Holden for our subject, but with a really different perspective. We both kind of feel that Holden isn't a fuckboy, even though a lot of people on Twitter definitely think he is.
Very delightful to get into conversation on Twitter where somebody was on the same side as me with the Holden Caulfield thing right away.
I had a lot of the opposite
conversation online.
Yeah, people really have like a virulent dislike for him, which I've never really understood.
Yeah, I got some theories, but we'll get to it.
But I do also give people a side eye, like when they say like The Catcher in the Rye is their favorite book. I'm always just like, maybe not. But I do genuinely have affection for Holden.
Yeah.
How old were you the first time you read the book, The Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah. So I think in some ways, I think this is part of it because I was 19.
Gotcha.
And I was still in high school when I was 19 because I had dropped out of every school.
Oh, wow.
And so I had dropped back into school at 19 and I read it by myself. So I never had it assigned for a class.
Gotcha.
Even after taking like the umpteen million English classes that I took.
Yeah, me too.
Having dropped out of every school. I had never been assigned Catcher in the Rye for a class. I picked it up because it was my late grandfather's old copy.
Oh, that's really sweet.
And yeah, and so it was one of the books of his that I went through a few years after his death. And I think for fairly obvious reasons from the first page kind of resonated with Holden.
Absolutely.
And so I think what's changed there is that I think I was felt in some ways, like very in the moment with Holden. So right away was like very snap judgment kind of defensive of Holden.
Oh, definitely.
At that time. And now I still, you know, I go, man, this kid, like
yeah,
my heart.
Your heart has to open for him. Absolutely. Like, it's just baseline. Like one of his siblings had passed away. And then he's a misfit. He doesn't feel like he belongs anywhere. And I don't find him obnoxious when he's narrating these things. He was far more level-headed and emotionally raw than pretty much most 17-year-old, you know, boy characters in literature. I found him quite endearing.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's also, I find, I mean, my feelings about Salinger are so complicated.
Yeah, Salinger is like a whole other bowl of worms.
I don't even know if we want to get into that. I do want to share one thing. Kind of going off on the Salinger track, and it might be the only thing I want to say about him. I might try to make it the only thing I want to say about him. Fair enough. He died, my friend Alicia Rubishaw, who is a wonderful poet, people can Google, said that man wrote himself a beautiful letter and never opened it.
Oh.
And at the time I was thinking about that in the context of like his reclusivity, but the more I look and especially look at sort of the innocence of a lot of his teenage characters.
Absolutely.
And then the fact that, you know, Salinger for a very long time was carrying on with women much younger than him.
Yes.
And girls much younger than him.
Yes.
And really exploiting that innocence, I get so angry.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not like he didn't know, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's not like he didn't know what teenagers are. It's not like he didn't know
Yeah.
That they're not adults.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like the first term, like serious term paper I ever wrote was in high school. And it was all about how Holden Caulfield just personified like the typical American teenager. And so it's so perfect in the fact that in just his entire characterization. So you're right. It's not like he didn't know the delineation between teenager and adult. He had to have. He wrote the perfect one.
And to have written Holden Caulfield, to have written Franny, you know, Franny and Zooey, like, yeah, it's just, it's really that it makes me even angrier, right?
Exactly.
Like the facts of the matter are angering enough. And then you look at the depth of how he was able to reflect on this. Mm-hmm. So that's, definitely having more context of the author is a way that my feelings change over time. I definitely take a step back from the work. Whereas when it was just this book from my grandfather's library, I was really just reading it as a, like, Holden was there in front of me and Salinger was nobody, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You think that this character sort of came from the ether, and instead, you know, knowing more background about the author, especially as you mature and grow and your values on what is appropriate or inappropriate relationship or viewpoints.
Yeah, absolutely.
I understand how people can make the argument that Holden is kind of a jerk, because he is, because all teenagers are jerks. I stand by that, you know, that's a hill I'm willing to die on, is that like most teenagers are kind of assholes. Like it's just in the personality. It's part of growing. So that's one of the reasons why, like, now as an adult, like being 33 and having my friends being like, he's an irreparable jerk. No, he's 17. He's probably going to grow out of it.
I wanted to keep myself honest. So as I was reading, I made a list of times when Holden Caulfield is arguably being a fuckboy. We'd like to hear some of these examples.
Oh, absolutely.
My first one was when he calls up the burlesque dancer in the middle of the night. Very fuckboy move.
Yes, very much. Exactly. It's the equivalent of a you up text.
Nice lady. You up text, and he's never talked to her. This is just some lady that some guy told him existed. Yeah, very fuckboy move. Some of these kind of have two sides, and I'm like, oh boy. So that when he's trying to get this girl to dance, while in his mind he's calling her and her friends names, and he's saying he has this whole conflict around, like, some of which is, I think, kind of virgin whore stuff.
That's true. That's rampant.
Fooling around with girls he doesn't like. But then he's like, I think stupid girls are better dancers. He's working his head around some thoughts about women, which to me, what saves this is that I think he's getting there.
Yeah, I agree. I was reading a bunch, I'm sure you're going to bring this up, but when he's with a prostitute and he is sort of, you know, justifying calling her up, because at one point he says, when I'm with a girl and she says no, I stop.
Yeah.
And that's just like mind-blowing now, let alone in 1951.
Yeah. Well, and the really heartbreak, because that comes up a couple of times. And one of the times is when he's talking about going on double dates with Stradletter, his roommate. And he, he's so wrapped up in this culture where, like, rape is so normalized.
It's just, of course,
he feels
if you're
like
a prep school
a failing
boy.
Of his that he is like, I can't do that.
Yeah, I can't be
Why
in the same room with
weird?
This person
because
who's doing this.
That's clearly the normal thing.
Right.
And then he joins their table without invitation. All these, you know,
social
people
faux pas.
Trying to have a nice, like, business trip. He's just kind of stepping in it there.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be at that table, for sure.
Exactly.
For sure. And then most of the rest of the stuff is with Sally. I think from Sally's perspective, for sure. If Sally wrote this book, Holden Caulfield
would just,
absolute fuckboy.
You'd absolutely want to punch him. Just absolutely.
Yeah. Although, the other thing is, I was thinking about this from Sally's perspective, and I'm like, think about how this kid looks when he shows up on that date.
I know.
He has been in two fist fights in the past like 12 hours. Like, yeah. And there's not really a moment when she's like, are you okay?
No, never once.
So I think Sally's a little, like,
a little suspect. Clueless. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not like rooting for this to work out.
No.
On any level. But I'm just like, I never have I more wanted a girl to just like, you know, cut her losses and just like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Get out of that, right. She runs into that other boy on the day. I'm like, you know what? Like you could just, yeah, stick with him.
Yeah,
go just see the show this way. He seems to be enjoying it. Holden hates this shit.
Yeah, just like cut and run, go to the bathroom, don't return. Your coat, yeah, is an acceptable loss. Just, yeah, it's fine.
You don't need each other. You do not need each other. No. In any sense of the word. Yeah. So those are kind of my yeah. Okay. Holden. From these characters' perspectives at these moments, what a fuckboy.
Yeah. I think it's also hard as someone who went to just like, I didn't go to public school my entire life. I went to Catholic school for my first 3 years. But like after that, I went to public school and just like, if you say prep school to me, I'm like, oh, you're an asshole.
Mm.
Just plain and simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope you didn't go to prep school at any point.
I did not.
I did just insult the crap out of you.
No, I did not. I dropped out of every public school, which in Ontario includes Catholic schools.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yes. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Which is handy when you live in a small town that there's an alternative public high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, there's just something about him that does just like reek of like, you want to be Cher from Moonstruck and just slap him and be like, snap out of it. What's the matter with you? But of course, as the book continues, you just kind of realize, oh, this is not something he can just snap out of. It's not just an attitude problem.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I was thinking about how like the reader's perspective kind of maybe both helps and hinders the reader's ability to empathize with him.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, you don't just see that date from Sally's perspective.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's that. So for some readers, that's a big help. But then you're also, sometimes you're seeing so much of his interior life. Like, you know, for example, that situation at the table is way worse from inside his head.
Absolutely.
Because he's having just like an absolute cacophony of nightmare thoughts.
Yes. It's one of those things where, you know, people now, when I'm querying books, you see so many agents looking for unreliable narrators. And I think it's difficult. And not until recently did people start to realize that if a book is taking place literally 99% inside someone's head, the person who's delivering the information to you is not reliable. You're not getting a well-rounded view of how everybody interacts with the world because Holden Caulfield is one person. He can't give you that well-rounded of a view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think like, you know, and some, that's not the purpose of the viewpoint. And I think, so I think trying to figure out sometimes who some of these other people are is kind of an unsolvable puzzle.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like they're a little bit these blank canvases that he's just kind of projecting on a lot.
And if he hates them, you're going to hate them too. And sometimes you're looking at a person and you're going, I like this person. This is the kind of person that I would want to be around. But if he hates them, you're just like, I don't understand. Why are you being such an asshole to this person? Why are you, you know, ignoring your little sister or things along those lines where he's not behaving in a way that you would expect him to? I find his relationship with his little sister, Phoebe, to be just like the most endearing aspect of him. Like that to me saves him from falling into just like extreme fuckboy territory.
Yeah. And I think that is like its sort of narrative purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just, it's so interesting because Phoebe is a little adult.
Yes. She really
Phoebe is a little adult, and Holden is just looking at her like, I am looking at adulthood and I hate it.
Yep.
And I'm looking at your version of adulthood and I love it. And I want that to be, can we do that?
Yeah,
can
exactly.
Can we do that instead of this?
Exactly.
And so he's kind of, yeah, I find that very, very sweet. And I just, I'm like, yeah, no, I see what you mean. I mean, yeah. As somebody who spends a lot of time with kids, like, there's sometimes there's moments where you get like just a snap of like a kid's perspective on the adult world. And I'm like, man, I wish it
that's
was like
so
that.
Much better. Exactly.
Yeah, you got some good ideas.
I think it's interesting too, because Holden is definitely characterized as someone who looks like an adult. It's said specifically that he's 17 and 6'2". And that he just, you know, he doesn't look like a child anymore. And he's not going to be able to pass for a kid, you know, especially in the early 1950s, much longer. He's got a countdown of months. And so for him to look at this like really just like charming kid and feel so much affection for her and so much desire for that sort of innocence is just really, it really makes me empathize with him more than I think most people do nowadays.
Yeah, I think it's like, I think it's the sharpest insight we do get onto like, what is it that Holden, when he's looking at everybody and like for vague reasons, he's like, this person's a phony and this is all, you know, bullshit or whatever. And it's, and when you see like the things he picks out about Phoebe that he's just like, she's just fantastic in this way.
Yes.
It's like, oh, he wants it to be another thing.
Yeah.
He wants adulthood to be what children think adulthood
exactly.
is.
And if he could fix it, he absolutely would. Like you can, I kind of always got the impression that he just wanted to like make the adult, like you were saying, the adulthood that's bearing down on him go away so Phoebe could just have, you know, this essence that she wanted. And so he could protect her, and not in a way that he didn't think that she couldn't handle it, but it's that she shouldn't have to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the thing is like, yeah, it's not like shielding her from the world. It's like, I want her to have the world.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I want the world to be a place that is like worthy of her. That I want her to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Regrettably, I don't remember off the top. I looked it up. Do you recall how his brother died?
Was it like tuberculosis?
Yeah, some kind of disease that people illness. Shouldn't be dying
of
anymore.
Oh, no, it was leukemia.
Oh, you're
it was
right.
Leukemia. No, it was, yeah, it was cancer.
So it's something that's like generally treatable now, but was 100% a death sentence in the early 1950s, which is one of the reasons why I like never understood why people didn't cut him more slack.
Yeah, well, I mean, also seemed like when he talks about the night that Allie died and he punched out all the windows in the garage. Like I'd forgotten that scene until I reread this. And I'd totally forgotten that scene. And that's, I think one of those moments when you see, I think it's also significant that his younger sibling who's still living and who he's really invested all of this sort of like his vision of what the world could be into is a girl.
Yes. I completely agree.
Because a lot of the things he's gone through are because of like expectations around manhood.
Yeah.
And I think like the first like stark example of that we see is like, well, I punched out all the windows and they were like thinking about taking me to a shrink, and then it just kind of trails off and it doesn't, you know, it really doesn't indicate that he really got any serious help at that time.
Yeah,
he really
no.
just got sent away to school.
Exactly. It was, you're going to go to a shrink if you continue to show any kind of emotion, not if you continue to show bad emotions or if we're worried about you, we're going to get you help. It was, anytime you're showing emotions over the death of your brother, you're going to have to go to a shrink who's going to tell you how to tamp them down.
Yeah, no, it was a threat, not an offer, right?
Like, absolutely.
It's really, yeah.
That's the perfect way to describe it.
Yeah. And so when I look at a lot of those moments and and just like the way he's, you know, trying to navigate. The other thing I find so interesting is he really likes hanging out with women he's not necessarily attracted to.
That's true. That's very true.
He's like, the best conversation he has is with the nuns. You know, and he like somewhere like on the first page, like, you know, he comes in and he wants to talk to Mrs. Spencer and he wishes like they could carry on their conversation.
Yeah.
He's talking about like the headmaster's like daughter and he sort of goes on and he's like, she, you know, she wasn't very pretty or whatever, and sort of like almost like he's apologizing.
Yeah.
Sort of like, I know I'm only supposed to want to talk to pretty girls, but like,
yes, that's she was a just really so, good like, point.
Not full of shit. And I liked that about her, and I just wanted to hang out and be her friend. And even when he's talking about Jane, he has these moments where he's like, I really liked her, and like I did like her that way.
Yeah.
But it also was not about the fact that she was pretty. Like,
yeah, he like I genuinely enjoyed her personality, the things we talked about, you know, her sense of humor.
Yeah, and the more he likes a girl, the less he will say about what she looks like. There's no physical description of Jane whatsoever in this
right.
book.
Right. But if mm-hmm. there is a glowing physical description of her, usually it's followed by negativity or unsureness
right.
on his behalf.
Yeah, well, like Sally, he's all over the place, right? Because he's really, you know, he's like, he feels like he admired her legs, and now he has to be like, she's not so smart about this or that or whatever. And I'm not sure if I should be, you know, if she fits within my, like, if I really like a girl.
Yeah, what do I do about it sort of situation.
Yeah. No. It's really, the physical descriptions, I find that, like, the way they zoom in and pull back.
And who they get applied to and who they don't.
Who they get applied to and who's, I find it very interesting, like, especially because it's very different when he focuses, like, totally apart from women he's in any way attracted to. When he focuses on women's imperfections, it's often in the course of talking about how much he likes them.
Yes.
When he's focused on, like, men's physical imperfections, it's like this very deep discomfort thing.
Right. With the mossy teeth.
Yeah. And I think
Holden's discomfort with men is a whole thing. Like, it's really interesting how in some ways sparingly this sort of like history of trauma mm-hmm. is sprinkled through there. It's like, this is definitely a kid who has some kind of history of sexual abuse.
Really?
Yeah.
I elaborate on that because that is something that had not occurred to me.
So it, hang on. I think it's on my discomfort with men list.
Not to laugh at that, but
yeah,
I just
yeah, no,
appreciate it.
So the clearer things about it, like he starts to say it like a little more bluntly towards the end. But when he has that like uncomfortable interaction with his old teacher, mm-hmm. he said that kind of stuff's happened to me about 20 times since I was a kid.
Right.
And that's like the clearest thing he says, like, but he also has this whole, when he's talking to his friend, who's probably gay, mm-hmm. He has this whole thing of like, he knows that he's like conflating, like being gay with bad boundaries.
Right.
And he's like going through these things in his head. He's like, this guy's my friend. And I know like, he's probably this, I don't know, like, or like, I know a lot of people are that way, but I don't know. Like, and he's kind of going back and forth. He's like, I really hate that. So he's like, his culture hasn't given him any script to deal with that.
That's true.
But what he is referring back, he like has these flashes of referring back to things that seem to have happened to him that he was uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm. He wished he had the boundaries to say yes, no, you know, good, bad mm-hmm. sort of parameters exactly. for how to deal with it.
Yeah. I think it really plays in a lot too when we see like his real physical discomfort with men mm-hmm. in a lot of situations. I think that's like trauma.
Interesting. No, that makes perfect, absolutely perfect sense.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the thing that I find like
compelling about him.
Compelling and that I think the way it's written is so
veiled.
I think it's so veiled in a really truthful way that he's kind of like half braided. He like knows it's happened. It's mm-hmm. there, but he also like has no real context to talk about it.
Right.
Oh, that's so like
that makes perfect sense.
He relates it to these other things he sees in like his friends or in the culture, and he's like, it's not quite like that, but it's
similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, definitely makes me look at like when he says things that are, you know, quite homophobic. It it does come through this different lens. I read it differently than I would read in another book of this era where I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's coming from hurt and not hate. It's something different.
Yeah, and it is because he is trying to talk himself out of it. And I find really fascinating for a book of this era that he's kind of like, he's trying to have fun with his friend and kind of saying like, but he's also like, he's not uncomfortable with this guy.
Right.
But there's something about this that like makes him uncomfortable. And he's sort of like trying to puzzle it out, but also kind of dissociating. He's often dissociating when he's alone in rooms with men.
Interesting.
Like from the first, when he meets with Spencer, Mr. Spencer before mm-hmm. he leaves. Mm-hmm. And which is such a weird moment anyway, because he's alone in his teacher's room and his teacher's in his bathroom.
Yeah.
And so like uncomfortable anyways. But that's the first time he's like obsessing about the ducks in the park.
Right. Right.
He is doing anything to leave the room. And that seems to be like, I think it comes up a couple times when he's alone in rooms with men.
Mm-hmm. Where he's doing everything he can to block a situation or focus on something else.
Yeah. Just be elsewhere. Like, and the other thing is like, part of his whole phony thing, mm-hmm. I think, is about this like mistrust of power.
That makes sense.
And mistrust, like he has this immediate mistrust of anyone successful, especially men. He really mistrusts successful men, even when he likes them. It makes him feel away.
Right. It like an inherent distrust of perhaps how they got it or a suspicion.
Yeah. No, I find that, I think that the fact that I think that's coming from like a real place of like genuine hurt and fear,
mm-hmm.
to me, like, I think that there's another reading of this book that I understand again, like why people are like, oh, he's just whining all the time and whatever. And it's like, yeah, if you don't see a right. hurt little kid.
Yeah. If you refuse to treat him like a child, which I think that is it's an interesting conversation that has to be have of like when teenagers do things with their adult brain and when teenagers do things with their kid brain. And I feel like more often than not, Holden does, he views the adult world through his kid brain.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
And that's not really mm-hmm. the most eloquent way to say it, but I think it kind of gets to the essence of the book. And a lot of people read him as an adult fuckboy, you know, for lack of a better term, with an adult brain. And I just really have never gotten the feeling that that was the appropriate way to approach him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that kind of sums it up. Like, I think a lot of it, he kind of goes back and forth between, I think a lot of the phony stuff is sometimes him trying to put on this like adult persona
mm-hmm.
that he's above it all,
mm-hmm.
but then like he'll go back in this like kid brain like perspective on things a little bit.
Yeah, because one of the things that I always loved about him is that he does have very clear set boundaries on what he thinks mm-hmm. is appropriate or inappropriate behavior, which you've touched upon basically throughout this entire conversation, and also just simple things like swearing. Like he will swear an awful lot, but then when he sees graffiti on the wall with a curse word in it, he's like, I have to get rid of that because a kid might see it.
I know. Oh my gosh. And that's the thing is like he wants the world to be a world that's good enough for his kid sister, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. He also like he is becoming an adult.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's like you're kind of watching he's a polywog. You're watching him turn into a frog.
Yeah.
But you also like, it's also because you have almost like two narrative timelines going on at once.
That's very true.
So like, I think when it comes back to a lot of the stuff where he's like trying to wrap his mind around like how he feels about these girls or how he feels about whatever, it's like he's trying to put those two timelines together. And he's like, I know I felt this way at this time, but now I'm looking at it. You know, and there's got to be some overlay there. You know,
there's got to be a way to reconcile like, this in his
some
brain.
Some of this has to be later analysis, right?
Yeah.
And then he's going, I acted that way, but I don't like it. And
exactly.
I know that I didn't like it then, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So like, yeah, so I think that's, you know, I think keeping the, you know, when he's writing from and when things are happening and how much time is, mm-hmm. you know, lapsed. And the fact that, you know, I think one of the most unreliable things is when he says something like, I always thought this, or I thought this at the time.
You can't
know, how much
that.
Of that is like, yeah, you know, how much of that is put in later, right?
Exactly.
Because he is coming from a place where he's had more time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And where he's able to look at all of this having happened at once, right?
Exactly. One thing that I really do feel about this is that, like, not only in 1951 were boys having emotions, which we've already discussed, like, you know, anathema to their concept of masculinity, but it's clearly not accepted now anymore mm-hmm. either. So I wonder how much of people's recoiling now in the year of 2019 is recoiling against this idea that teenage boys showing any kind of like sardonic reaction to things can be actual genuine feelings, or if they think it's just a sort of front or, you know, shield that they put up for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways, like, not that I go around asking people how they feel about Holden Caulfield, because I don't always want to get in a fight. But there is, you know, there's times when that comes up, and I think it's like an interesting litmus test for like, okay, some people have ideas that like, yeah, we don't want any of that toxic masculinity crap, but then like they'll say something about like, but this whiny little bitch.
Yes.
Like, dude.
You are internalizing that.
Yeah. He's figuring out his stuff. His brother died.
Exactly. He's being
sent away to school.
He's got no home, essentially. Like, he can't even like return to his parents' apartment in the city. He's just killing time because he doesn't
he's
know how to
get into his house.
Yes, because he doesn't want to see his parents. It's just heartbreaking. And if one more person tells me that he's a bad person because he lost like lacrosse equipment, I'm just going to.
That's wild.
It's like, how dare this child admit, you know, like a simple human error.
Oh my gosh. The most like 16-year-old boy thing.
Exactly.
He could do.
Exactly. I was at the doctor's office the other day and I watched a 50-year-old man leave his $1,000 iPhone behind. It was like, everybody forgets things. It's just a normal human moment.
Yeah.
And also, not for nothing, but like lethargy, distancing yourself from friends, mm-hmm. forgetfulness, bad grades, aggression, all of that is signs of clinical depression.
Yeah. And I had, like, obviously, when I read this, I was biased because I was such a little delinquent. But it's also, like, when you see that first conversation with Mr. Spencer, mm-hmm. and there's that moment when he hands him his essay.
Mm-hmm.
On the ancient Egyptians, and you see like the part he did write about what they were teaching him anyway.
Exactly.
And it's like the ancient Caucasian race, and it's like, well, they're teaching him a bunch of bullshit anyway. So like, not that I necessarily think Holden has that perspective on in either timeline, but like,
it's true.
You know,
that perspective wasn't available.
I mean, I do remember, you know, that you do have like one of the things that is difficult about high school is there are parts of it where people are trying to tell you things that aren't true.
Exactly.
And so, and those are the people who are supposed to tell you the things that are true.
And how can you tell the difference?
It's not a brain situation because you're just like, you need to figure out what are the true things. And clearly this is not a reliable source of information all
exactly.
the time. And especially when it's, you know, in this environment where he's in a house with a bunch of boys, young men, and mm-hmm. he's often quite uncomfortable with them. He has sort of like mixed relationships there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff with sort of teachers is like, and another thing that I think just like, for me, saves him. And I think ultimately saves him in the sense of like his survival.
Uh-huh.
Is that I think is a non fuckboy trait is that he wants to connect. He is constantly making the effort to
connect. That's a really good point. Because I don't. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a hermit. I don't really go out of my way to do an awful lot of connecting with other people. And it's emotionally healthy that he does. He's constantly seeking it out.
Yeah. And he's almost punishing himself with it sometimes.
True.
Because for about the first half of the book, he is constantly making an effort to connect with people he is just not connecting with.
Yeah.
And that's clear, like, on both sides, this isn't going to work out, dude.
Yeah. From the moment you opened your mouth, this was not your people.
Mm-hmm. And making excuses not to connect with the people that he has good relationships with.
True.
He makes excuses like, oh, I can't call Jane right now, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's thinking about, you know, he keeps thinking about calling Jane and then he calls Sally.
Mm-hmm. How much of that is self-sabotage and how much of that is culture dictating who is worthy of, like, a relatively well-off, like, prep boy's time? Because I think that's something else that a lot of people really don't, you know, put into the conversation either, is that as the now only surviving adult male son of a relatively well-off white New York City family, like, he's got societal expectations on his shoulders that he doesn't necessarily really want.
Yeah, I guess I haven't looked at it as much with that lens. Because I guess I was really thinking of it from the self-sabotage lens. Because he's coming from this place where, like, he's gotten beat up twice in the last, like, you know, a couple hours. And he just feels like he's, like, the bottom of the heap. And he has this idea, like, there will be a time when I get to talk to Jane. There'll be a time I get to connect with her. And there'll be a time I get to, like, reconnect with this, like, moment.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of, like, pure and wonderful and good. But he also is like, and this is not that time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to bring this into that. And he's like, I just got to set up some stuff in between now and then.
And then.
See if I get there. and what he's like, he's pushing himself into these conversations, into these things that for the most part make him really uncomfortable. You know, you have these little bits of respite when he's talking to the nuns or when he's talking to Phoebe. You know, but then he's often just, like, throwing himself into things that make him uncomfortable socially. Yeah,
exactly. And absolutely miserable.
Mm-hmm.
He's so interesting. And the more we chat about him, the more I just have, like, my heart swells for him. And I hope, you know, you hope that someone reads the story and gets what you possibly can't get out of it when you read it at, like, 16 to 19 years old.
Yeah, well, and when somebody's telling you to read it. And
that's
you have
true.
To, you know, because I didn't have that experience with this book, and I know that there are books that I had that experience with that I am probably never going to be able to get the full value out of.
Oh, absolutely. You know? half the books that we're discussing on the podcast, I'm just like, I read it in class and I hated every second of it and I'm never going to have love for it. And I'm talking to someone, you know, who got their PhD in it and you're just like, oh no, I'm insulting the hell out of you. But I just can't have that kind of affection for it.
Yeah, no, actually, one of the first friends I made in university, one of our first sort of, like, bonding, like, not even arguments, but just she was like, I love Lord of the Flies.
What?
And I was like, how?
Oh my gosh! Like,
yeah, and she was like, this is how I feel about this book, and I'm like, I will never be able to feel that way because 10th grade English.
Yeah,
but I'm very happy for you. And I've been able to have that conversation, you know, on the other end.
Right.
Like, with, you know, with somebody else of me, you know, talking them through, like, okay, but Holden Caulfield, when he's walking through the museum.
The joy. Nothing's
changed for you. Nothing's changed for you. And sometimes it's just that you saw a rainbow with gasoline puddles in it, or a gasoline puddle with rainbows in it.
Exactly.
Nothing's changed for you. The museum is the same.
Only you.
That's sort of one of the images that I have always carried from this book. And I'm just like, sometimes there's those places. Nothing changes but you. And you can't stop changing.
Because it's...
You don't get to walk through that museum the same.
It's the Natural History Museum, correct? In New York City?
Yeah.
Which I have to admit to you is my favorite museum in the entire world. I probably went there once a month when I was a kid, and it was just, it's heaven. It's absolute heaven. If you ever get a chance to go, please go, because it's my favorite place in the universe.
I haven't been to that one, but in my mind, it's the Natural History Museum in Ottawa. So I Canadianized it.
That's actually going to be my last question for you. And this might end up just being like a one-word answer. But I'm from the New York City area. I was born in Queens and I grew up in Connecticut, like 90 minutes outside of New York City. So a lot of Holden does feel very like New York to me, because I do recognize a lot of the places that he's been to. Is there something that is like demonstrably American about Holden, or is he just like completely universal?
I think like he is so New York that makes him universal, because we've seen movies.
Oh, that makes sense.
You know, like, because so if it was some other place and it was that specific.
Yeah. If it was like Minneapolis, you'd be like, who knows?
It might depend. Like Minneapolis is so like, you know, Minnesota is so Canada, but that might work. So if it was some other, you know, if it's like
Miami, maybe.
Yeah. That would be like a little, you know, you'd have to have some other touch point for it to feel like this is just another story. But I think because New York is such a, you know, like I've been to New York once for 30 hours.
Oh my gosh. That's so not enough time.
Exactly. But still, like, New York is a real place in my mind. Yeah. I'm like, it's there. It's always there.
But it exists. I also wonder if, like, when I talk to, like, Americans, because I'm sure it's everywhere, you know, all of our bullshit. So the fact that like a lot of people in America don't trust New Yorkers might be another reason why like people put up their, you know, their hackles get raised by him.
It's true. I did wonder, I was like, maybe Canadians don't have quite the same defensiveness. First of all, I'm not sure as many of us are assigned it based on my sampling size of 10th grade English courses.
True.
I'm not sure it's as commonly assigned, because I think we have other like Canadian things that got slotted in there.
I actually never read it like for class. I read it as like a book that I chose to do a book report on, but it wasn't assigned to me.
Okay. See, it may have been one of those at some point. But, like, we mostly get those kind of situations in like towards the upper grades. So I don't remember. I don't remember at any of the schools I went to it being on like any of those lists and like assigned in any way. I could be wrong.
I know that in America, it's one of the most banned books in school libraries. So like the American Library Association or some other organization keeps a list of like the most banned books in school and public libraries. And I think the first is Huckleberry Finn, and the second or third is probably The Catcher in the Rye.
Okay.
And I've never quite been able to figure out exactly why.
That does seem odd. That seems like an odd ranking.
Yeah, because none of the language is particularly salty. It's not like Huck Finn where the N-word is dropped all the time and you're just like, whoa, okay, no, this is uncomfortable.
And even the slurs are outdated.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, to my recollection, he never uses the F-word, like the F-word that we know as an F-word, referring to any gay men.
Right.
He uses flit.
Yeah.
Which is not a current thing.
No, it's not.
So charming and quaint.
It's true. It's very true.
So it doesn't seem like it's language on that level. And like the other F word, like fuck, is in there twice.
Yeah.
And he wants to erase it off the wall.
Exactly. Because he doesn't like it because it does make him uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And even the sex moment, you know, the sexually related moments are not, you know, saucy in any ways. They're not overt.
And they're not sexy.
No, they're not sexy at all.
It's like, because the most intimate moments, like, it's really part of the point is that, like, the most intimate moments is him, like, holding hands with Jane at the movie theater and playing checkers and, like, these really innocent moments.
Yeah, that you would, like, want 13-year-olds to have as dates.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
But there's also like no denying the fact that like his parents, I guess when you say he lives in an apartment in New York City, it was slightly different in 1950. Rents were significantly cheaper. But if you're a modern reader, you're going, you know, you have a family of three kids and two adults in an apartment in New York City. That's going to cost like $18 billion. And then he's right. going to prep schools and things like that. And I've often wondered if that sort of modern lens of looking at the privilege that he does have, but it's not quite the same. It's actually like worse now than it was back then.
Right.
If that makes people just immediately like discount him.
Well, it's also, yeah. I mean, I think so much of it is just like, if you don't look at the pain, which sometimes he's trying to hide.
Mm-hmm. Purposefully, because he's not supposed to have it.
Like the text in some ways makes it a little easier for you to ignore his very real problems.
Yeah.
Because he's wrapped up all the time in talking about like, these people are phonies and this is, and I hate this and I hate that. And the moments when we see like his real trauma and his real pain, they just like, they go by.
Yeah.
And you could have those moments where you're like, yeah, I read over that page and I didn't, you know, I didn't,
I didn't
on
see that.
Especially already just like mad at this like stupid prep school kid. I can see how you miss it.
Absolutely. Cause I didn't even see the assault subtext that you had brought up, but as soon as you mentioned it, it makes really perfect sense. Cause I couldn't understand ever why he was, you know, in a room alone with his teacher who's in his bathrobe and it's weird, but you don't, but at the same time, you know, I've never been to prep school. I'd never been to a school where you like sleep over. And so you're like, maybe this was more normal, you know, in a prep school. But to watch him get so uncomfortable with it, you start to understand that something, you know, weird is afoot at the Circle K.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like that's a situation where like bad boundaries are happening for sure. Like this doesn't seem right. It seems like a thing like now we would have more clear like policy boundaries on this. Like definitely you're not
exactly.
Wear pants. Good things for school teachers to be aware of.
Yeah.
But at that time, you know, maybe wasn't necessarily, you know, in writing anywhere. So it's like, whatever, the guy's sick. Okay, I'll come visit his room. I want to say goodbye before I leave.
But then just the deep discomfort.
Holding's reaction is coming from a place of bad boundaries means that I don't feel okay about this. Bad boundaries like set. So he's having a reaction that is not like, this is weird, but
can you believe this?
To have that reaction.
Yeah.
It seems like he's like, this is what the reaction is supposed to be. It's supposed to be, I'm not supposed to be fixated on the fact that like, this is happening. This is just like the circumstance in which I happen to be able to say goodbye to my teacher and I'm not, but this makes me feel weird.
Yeah.
And I'm going to think about Ducks in the Park.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you have to respect the fact that he, as a reader now, you have to respect the fact that he's being honest with you and saying, this is weird. I'm uncomfortable. I'm going to have to travel elsewhere in order to make it through.
And I thought of another moment that for me is like just that quick moment. Red flag is when he... Jane's stepfather just like walks through the room and has this like little interaction with her, which is not like anything overtly like strange. But seems to like, she just seems to be upset. They just don't seem to have a particularly good relationship.
Right.
And his immediate question to her is, has he ever gotten fresh with you?
Right.
Like it's on his radar.
Oh,
in a way
my gosh. That would not be a normal 17-year-old boy now or then.
Yeah, and that's when he's younger.
You're right.
Because that's with Jane. And so that's the summer. He's 14 then.
Oh, that's so young. That would never occur to someone who
hadn't had
that experience.
14-year-old boy in 1949.
Is sitting in a room with a girl that he wants to get fresh with.
Mm-hmm.
And then just seeing.
And just like something's there.
Something's wrong.
And he's like, I need to ask her. If this is the thing.
Yeah.
And he just puts
such an emotional maturity from a character now or then that it's making me doubly angry that people don't like him, because that is such a sense. That's something you want for teenagers and teenage boys to understand.
I mean, it is interesting because I hadn't even, because you do, when you have those J
Jane flashbacks and those other flashbacks further, like you're going deeper in time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I find, yeah, and a lot of there is where you get these little flashes of like, oh, something's happened to this kid.
Yeah. Something
beyond yeah. even what he's able to tell us.
Like, yeah. Beyond even just your brother dying of a mm-hmm. disease that had absolutely no cure at your time mm. in your time period.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just kind of left hanging. It's really interesting. And I don't know that I've ever read another book that it's written in that way that feels
where it stays subtext and never becomes
feels
text.
Very true. Yeah. Like,
so how, you know, situations that happen in a lot of people's right. lives where there's just something that's left hanging and you're just like, I don't know what to do about this.
Yeah. Where it feels like, I think the best way to describe it is like, it's a specter lurking behind you mm-hmm. and it's yeah. never going to become solid. So mm-hmm. you can easily discount it, but it is still lurking there.
Yeah. 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 I think that's kind of the space that it lives in. And I think like the way it's rendered on the page is really fascinating to me.
And so if you read it with more, you know, attention than we probably did when we were teenagers, you know, because you don't, when books are assigned or they're for school, you mm-hmm. don't usually read them with the fine tooth comb that you actually have to. So I think we should start to wrap it up and just say we're going yeah. to really implore people to go back and read this book as an adult with the emotional knowledge that we have, hopefully now, and, you know, come at Holden Caulfield like with a little bit softer hearts.
Yeah. Because the museum stays the same, but you've changed.
Exactly. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to chat with me about this because he's one of my favorite characters. And I really hope to have you back on the show because this was just really, really fun. I really appreciate it. Emmett, how can people find you on the internet if they want to keep in touch with you?
They can find me where you found me, which is on twitter.com. I'm at EMLFC.
So the letters EMLFC.
EMLFC.
Wonderful.
And on Patreon, if you want to search Emmett with one T, LF Cameron.
I slam as the boy with the purple socks at local poetry events in Perth, Ontario.
Which is a great
Ontario.
Name. Thank you.
Speaking of literary things, if you ever need somebody to... there's no fuckboys in Harriet the Spy, though. It is pure and golden.
It's true.
So.
And as always, listeners, you can find Fuckboys of Literature on Twitter at fuckboysoflit, that's B-O-I-S, and at fuckboysoflit.com. There are links to find us on YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever your preferred place for listening is. Until next time, I'm your host, Emily Edwards. Thank you so much. Goodbye.